Peace of Mind with Ken Pope. As a parent of a child with a disability or special needs, you need to navigate the complex legal issues of providing continued care and quality of life for your child. You need Peace of Mind with Ken Pope.
Good morning. This is Ken Pope with the Peace of Mind radio show. I'm sure you'll enjoy it. We're going to talk about something close to the heart of every parent who has a child in school, and that is how to get the proper assessments and IEPs and attentions and supports that our children need. And we'll also talk about the post-age 21 situation and our ESPs and our DSPs as well. My law practice specializes on a provincial basis and interprovincial basis as well, with assisting families with wills and trusts and estate planning and taxes and guardianship and so on. And of course, when the children are young, parents are generally preoccupied, I find, naturally enough. And they don't do any of those things until the child is at least 7 years old or, you know, somewhat occupied in school because they're just otherwise just too busy. And, you know, between the teacher strike and the coronavirus and the disruption of school right now, this is a very difficult thing, not only for all families, but for families who have kids with special needs. I mean, if you have a son or daughter with autism, this disruption in the schedule is a very, very difficult thing to deal with. You know, very disruptive. And for a lot of families, if you have a son or daughter who's 14 or 16 and, you know, school is closed, well, they can stay home themselves. But a lot of children, they can't be left alone. And there's no supports for them because they were in school. So that said, this is a especially trying time for a lot of my client families, and I wish them all well and good health. We have a special guest star with us today. Her name is Monica Ferenzi. She has a business called Horizon Educational Consulting. And for many years now, she has a long educational background. But more recently, last certain number of years now, she's been assisting families with one of the big bugbearers, and that is you have a child, they go to school, they have certain behaviors or certain issues, difficulties. The teachers alert you to these things. Perhaps there's disruption in the classroom. Perhaps they're blaming your child for the disruption. And you're trying to come to grips with these things. And so the child is in grade one. And of course, you need some assessment to see what's going on. Far too many children, in my humble opinion, are diagnosed by teachers, which, you know, especially boys. And I think that people need proper assessments and they need proper IEPs and they need the supports that they deserve. And that's what Monica specializes in. And it's very gratifying for me to be able to speak with her. We've just done a webcast, which will be somewhat similar to this radio show. If you'd like a copy of that webcast and the PowerPoints, you know, feel free, just contact the office, contact Karen at kpopelaw.ca, or .com, sorry, and she'll be happy to send you the recording, the link to the YouTube link, and the PowerPoints, both for myself and Monica. Monica, how are you weathering this at home? Are you self-isolating, or what are you doing?
Yes, thank you, Ken, for inviting me. I am at home. My practice is a home-based practice, and I see clients either in my home or in their home or often at schools with meetings. So it hasn't made a huge impact in the way that I do what I do in my daily work, but it certainly has for the families and clients that I do serve.
Well, that's excellent, and it's wonderful to be able to assist people remotely or on the time schedule that they have, because of course it's very interesting to me because, you know, if a parent will make an appointment to talk to me or perhaps to see me, and something comes up, and it's always something to do with the child. You know, it's not like they somehow just wanted to, you know, blow off the appointment. It doesn't work that way. So it's really wonderful that you and I can both deal with all these clients remotely as well.
Yes, that's very important, and particularly at this time, more and more of my contacts are either through phone or video conferencing platforms. And that has been hugely comforting to some of the parents who I have concerns with, who will not be able to access respite services in their home for them to get a break if they have a particularly high needs child and very demanding on their time and their capacity as a parent. And so I'm also there to support my current clients during this time in whatever they need, and offering them help on how they can further learning in their own home, because our homes are great classrooms and parents are the primary teachers in a child's life. But also for some, it may just be a question of survival and comfort and support at this time. So whatever the priority and the needs of the family are, I'm there to help them along.
How do you make the initial assessment of what they might need assistance with? Do you have an intake procedure and forms and boxes to tick, or how do you do it?
So I usually have an intake phone call with the client. That's usually about 15 minutes, which allows me to gather information on the background of the child and the experiences, any challenges, and any diagnosis that may play into their profile. And that helps me gather the right information to provide a parent in terms of direction and guidance in next steps and potential plans that could be put in place with the school or at home or with external service providers.
Yeah, my experience is that each family, there may be similarities, of course, between families, but of course that's true. But each family is unique. Each family is its own story.
Yes. And so the initial consultation that I have with them is about an hour, and it's a discussion, it's a sharing session. And from that, I can glean the parents' biggest preoccupations and challenges, and we always address those first. And sometimes they are more medical or health related than learning related. So I help the parent prioritize what the most important thing is for the well-being of the child and the well-being of the family. And then from there, we can decide what next interventions to do. Formal assessments, as in standardized assessments, sometimes are not conducive when a child is in a state of dysregulation or post-trauma or going through difficult situations with family or school. And unfortunately, school sometimes is a traumatic experience for some children, inadvertently, but that's because of the lack of training and sometimes sensitivity of staff, but those are all factors into the situation and circumstance of the family that I'm helping at that particular time.
What do you think is the most common problem that they face? The main motivator when they come to see you? What's their basic need, do you think?
It's a very high level of frustration that educators don't understand the needs of their child or don't know how to implement the individual education plan, IEP, on a day-to-day basis in the classroom because they lack training or they lack support. Support can be material support or human resources support, such as an educational assistant in the room, but it also can be moral support, and that is dependent on the type of leadership offered by the school principal in the building and what that school principal's background, expertise, or knowledge is of special education and their whole approach to managing certain situations in their building.
Makes sense to me, yeah. That's similar to the process we have as well, to see what's most important, where to start first. There's often two or three different issues. You know, people need wills, they need fence and trusts, but first they need to, you know, use some tax credits, and perhaps the child is 18 and they're not getting the full amount of ODSP benefits and so on. And then, yes, of course, they're lying awake at night, especially these days, lying awake at night worrying about what'll happen to my child when I'm gone. And that may well be the first thing that moved them to contact us, but it may well be the last thing that they do. The parents that you work with, would they mostly be people with children with cognitive issues or learning disabilities, or what would you say is most common?
The primary grouping of my clients are parents of children on the autism spectrum.
Oh, I see.
And I have a growing number of adult clients who are dependents and whose families contact me because they are in that post age 21 piece where they don't go to school anymore and at this point in time end up back in the home full time. And some institutions have started education programs for those types of students on an auditing type basis. They're not credit bearing or degree or diploma granting programs, but it at least allows the young adult to attend school. But I am also concerned, and when I see a youth in that age group where they're finishing off their schooling years from 16 to 21, I also inquire about their ODSP and whether they've made applications and setting up their future for them. And so I've been very lucky to have met you and know your services because it's a critical element for my parents that they don't often think of. And I do make that part of my intake. And I am astounded at the number of families who don't have a will in place. And I often present that reality to them. You know, what if something happens to you tomorrow? Who's taking your care of your child? Who's gonna get the SSAH funding and the OAP funding if you're not there? And the blank look and fear on their faces prompts them to take action in that area as well. But you are right. It's often at the very bottom of their list when I think it should be very much at the top because anything can happen from one day to the next.
Yeah. Well, you know, my experience is that as far as all of these things happening, you know, it's a moving picture for the families, you know, as the child gets older and they move from primary school to middle school to high school. Each time there's a change, there's new hurdles, new barriers, new things to learn, new people to meet, new obstacles to overcome. And they're very busy. That's my experience.
Yes, and sometimes these changes happen mid-year. It didn't used to happen that they would change personnel out in the middle of a school year, maybe 10, 15 years ago. And new principals who come into the building and parents having to re-educate a staff working with their child on a constant basis is a very, very high frustration item and contributes to their burnout with the school system as well. So I work very much on providing some quick documentation that the parent can always update and present in a 30-second format to anyone working with their child to ensure continuity in approach to the child or the young person in high school. Change has become an element of the school system and a huge contributing factor to much of the dysfunction. I often get the question of why are kids having so much trouble with school these days? And part of that answer is because of the disruption in the system itself in terms of what collective agreements have brought for staff and staffing and respecting those collective agreements in terms of lunch hours, time off, sick days. And so that produces a huge turnover in the school system. And that is a great element of disruption. So while we have coronavirus and a strike and seasonal illnesses, the underlying factor is the way that the system now operates as opposed to 10, 15 years ago.
Yeah, I quite agree. Well, we just have to move forward. So where would you say you start? I mean, do you assist people to get assessments done? There's often a year's waiting list to get assessments. Do people need assessments to have IEPs?
They don't need assessments to have IEPs because IEPs are based on the ministry guideline and policy that it's a need that drives an IEP. So a parent needs to express this need in writing to a school principal, but there should be some ongoing initiative in place to be on wait lists for assessments. With younger children, the most important assessments are hearing, vision, and sensory, which is usually an occupational therapist who undergoes that because all of that has to do with how they function on a day-to-day basis in the classroom. And our classrooms these days are very busy places. The kids don't sit in rows and desks, and the teacher doesn't teach at the front anymore. They're using technology and PowerPoint and there are these practices and these special events, and there are more and more children, I find, as parents tell me, we have young children that are 7 and 8 years old, and they're on a rotary class system where they will have 2 or 3 or 4 teachers. And so the expectation for them to keep up with the expectations of 3 or 4 adults in different classrooms or learning contexts is huge.
Yeah.
And that is also one of the elements that causes a lot of challenge and frustration, particularly to students with special needs, but even to neurotypical students in those classrooms, because change is just so prevalent.
That's absolutely true. I mean, anyone who's been through the educational process realizes that knowing who your teacher is and what their expectations are and what supports they're going to give you and what their material is like is critical to the whole education game, you know?
Yeah. Hmm. Assessments do form an important part, because schools won't react until the parent provides evidence that there is a need. So parents can express the need and an IEP can be put in place, but in all honesty, the teachers and the staff at school need information to work from in order to accommodate the child, and those will come from professional assessments. But there are a lot of assessments that can be done in the meantime, and a lot of exploratory items that relate to how children function before those formal psychological assessments are initiated. And that's often what the school staff will indicate to a parent as being necessary, when it's really at the top end of the assessment scale in terms of need, because many things are related to eating and sleeping habits, their sensory processing, which many special needs children, regardless of their diagnosis, will have sensory processing issues. And so an occupational therapy assessment, having their vision and hearing checked, are the basics that we start with. And then there's speech language. And these are all accessible in the community without any doctor referral. And then once we have initial information, we can put an IEP together for the child. And then while we wait for more formal assessments, and I provide academic assessments with standardized testing tools that can be provided to the schools and incorporated into the IEPs, and they will show what the child is capable of doing. And that will provide information much faster to staff in how to adjust the learning and the accommodations for the child, and give some initial fact information to draw on. And then we can explore the child's potential or any other learning obstacles or challenges as a second step.
Well, I've seen IEPs, of course, coming from teachers' schools to the parents. Could the IEP be initiated by the parent? Could it be pushed that way rather than, you know, simply set in front?
In my practice, I've seen that it is the parent who is initiating. I find it very rare these days that a school will initiate a request to the parent to put their child on an IEP. And that's strictly because of the administrative burden that goes along with creating an IEP and then adhering to it. The principal is ultimately responsible to ensure that the IEP is implemented. And so what I have learned in my practice is that principals, some principals, are actually telling parents that their child doesn't need an IEP, they can manage the situation, to wait and watch, or to go get an assessment before an IEP can be put in place, which is not accurate information, and also to not identify their children through an IPRC process. And the IPRC, which is the Identification Placement Review Committee, is the legal process in the education system to ensure that a child is accommodated according to their learning needs. And I find that it is certainly, in certain circumstances, I have had principals badger parents not to initiate an IPRC. And I find that that's a violation of the parental rights to have in place what they are legally entitled to, and that they ask for in writing and yet do not receive.
If a parent wanted to find the simplest method to contact you to ask more questions about that, how would they do it? Would they go to your website or send email, or what would they do?
Yes. If they go to my website, which is Horizon Educational Consulting, they can send me a message. My phone number is there as well, 613-612-6842. And I would be happy to help them out and provide some information and resources for them to alleviate whatever tensions or challenges are presently being faced by them and with the school situation.
I'd like us to discuss for a short while. We have another roughly 10 minutes. I'd like to discuss what happens when children turn 18, age 21, and so on. I'll say a few things, and then if you'd be kind enough to come in and make comments as well. So when a child is approaching age 18, they should apply, the parent should apply for the child normally, if this is appropriate, they should apply for ODSP, Ontario Disability Support Benefits. And at that point, they could be in school, and they could continue in school, for example, until they're 21, high school, in appropriate cases. And they could also receive provincial benefits, monthly benefits. They would get $896 or $1169 a month financially, and they would have drug and dental coverage and certain other supports. And they would be acknowledged as a child with special needs, which is sometimes of assistance when they're going on from high school to college or university. And then there's the fact that they can stay until they're 21. And then what happens? I mean, if they turn 21, the parents, there's never the level of support that is generally needed for the child after they turn 21. So what do you do then? And I'll let you come back to that. And one of the most common questions I get is that when the parents and when the child is younger, they're debating whether to set up an RESP, which you should, I think. And then if the child is approved for the disability tax credit, should they have an RDSP? And do they need both, or should they have both? And my usual advice is to go ahead, set up the RESP, because eventually if the child could go to college or university or some form of post-secondary education or training, it's very flexible as far as the number of hours that are required to qualify. And you could even, like I remember some years ago, a group of my client families got together. They had children with similar needs and special needs. And they went to Algonquin and they fashioned a course for the kids. There's no reason you can't do that. It's still a post-secondary program. And, RESPs are still very flexible until age 35. And then you get to a point where perhaps you realize that the child won't be making use of this RESP. And should you set up an RDSP? And what about the money you've put into the RESP and so on? Well, of course, the RESP belongs to the parent. The RDSP belongs to the child. And once you put money into an RDSP, you can't get it back, basically. But you can take the money out of the RESP at any time, and there's minor repercussions, small repercussions. But you could then use it to start the annual funding of the RDSP if you're not going to use it for educational purposes. So there's no conflict there. And once once my experience is that once you start spending money on a child, it's not so much that you wind up spending less as time goes by, it's that you just spend it on different things as they get older. But, so there's that side of it. And then there's the fact that colleges and universities are very accommodating. I had a very interesting discussion a few months back with a teacher from one of the colleges. And what's happening is that a lot of the children with special needs or learning disabilities or issues, attention deficits, and various things, right? They're getting into colleges, they're getting into universities, but let's just focus for now on colleges. So what happens is they're there, and then as they take their courses, especially in first year, they find that maybe they have to slow down their course load. That's pretty common. And then they find that even so, they have trouble with exams, and maybe they didn't properly take notes, from day one. And so now they need accommodations to, to have notes read to them. And maybe they couldn't take part in the exam for various reasons. So what's happening, I found it fascinating, is that the colleges and universities are providing all these accommodations because in a sense it's human right, in a sense. But all of the tuition fees are all fixed. So just how they're going to deal with the fact that after the fact, people self-identify or identify and show themselves to be you know, students with special needs and need special supports that are above and beyond what the other kids that are paying the standard fixed fees are. How are they going to weather this in a world with more and more students with special needs all the time, doing better, doing long, going along to school longer? It's fascinating, and it's not something that, you know, a couple of decades ago was an issue. We have a couple of more moments. Do you have any comments on those things?
Yes. So I always encourage my clients to apply for the DTC, the Disability Tax Credit, and open the RESP and RDSP. And I do that in the hopes that that RESP will develop some flexibility in the future. Because right now the challenge is if the child needs to go to a special education high school or private high school or private college, those aren't covered. Some are, but not all of them. But I always consult and advise parents to open that RESP. And once they are in university, though, what you mentioned is the reduced workload or timetable. They can qualify as full-time students and take up to one-third or one-quarter of their course load and in a reduced timetable. So what they actually are entitled to is a deferred program completion. And in order for that to occur, though, this is where those assessments become critical, because right now the post-secondary institutions require a psychoeducational assessment done in the last 2 years prior to their first year of enrollment in order to offer them any accommodations. And the IEPs from the high schools really don't have any weight in the post-secondary system. So that's where those assessments. So when students get into that 16 age group range, that's when I suggest to clients to get those assessments done to apply for the ODSP and you know, use any RESPs that are available. There is also OSAP that many students qualify for. And through OSAP, they can get those deferred program completion timelines or the reduced workload timetables. So they're taking two courses instead of a full load of four. And then there's the Canada Grant and Bursary for Services and Equipment, which allows note takers and recording devices, laptops, and any equipment that they need or any human support that they would need in terms of tutoring and counseling to get them through.
That's excellent, Monica. We have to wrap up now, but it's been a fascinating discussion. I appreciate your taking part.
Thank you very much for the invitation, Ken.
And if anyone wants to contact Monica, simply Google her website, Horizon Educational Consulting. And as far as my office, of course, just contact us at any time, K-Pope Law. Other than that, we'll speak with you again next month. And if you have questions, feel free to ask Karen at kpopelaw.com.